Good morning, everybody. My name is Vinoy Shaw, and I am a member of Al-Anon. Hi, y'all. It is so good to be in Texas. I understand y'all, and y'all understand me. And I want to thank Larry and the committee for inviting me, and I, too, think it's very touching to be asked to be one of the first of a very successful. The room was packed last night. I don't know what y'all going to do them tonight when that Yankee talks. And so I'm touched and pleased, and thank you, and thank you, Sam. I got off the plane yesterday, and a driver picked me up and took me to this healthy place to eat. I mean, and then I got a massage, and then my hairdresser cut my hair and dressed it and came to the hotel with me, and she's here at my service. I mean, that is quite a pleasure. And I enjoyed the speakers, and I'm really looking forward to those to come. And I got to tell you something about Debbie. She likes the bling. She mentioned her wedding last night. I talk about her wedding all the time. One of her weddings, the last one, the current one. She had it in this gorgeous hotel. It was just beautiful. And y'all know that, is it 2001 Odyssey? You know that boom, and then the boom, boom, and all that stuff? Y'all know that? You know, it's got sequences. And the first boom thing that happened, the first big drum, Kent walked out on the stage. And y'all remember the cat in Alice in the Wonderland? That and then another boom, and then here comes little sweet little Millie, just cute as she can be, this tiny little thing, and she comes parading down, goes up these steps to the stage, and then the real big boom, 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 and the door opens, and out walks Debbie. Now, she loves Gone with the Wind. And you know how they dress with those big hoops dresses? She had on a bright red hooped dress, and it had stars all over it, and the big man had given her star diamonds, and it was on the big boom, 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 boom. And when she walked in that red, of course, we're expecting virginal white. I don't know. Don't know why that crossed our minds, but... And she's in this giant dress, and you could hear everybody in the room. It was almost a collective. Then the next thing is, of course, it's Debbie. And that room erupted with applause and whistles and yays, and she's grinning almost as big as he is. And she just floated down that. It was awesome, and I applaud you. I have talked about that wedding. I hope you, do you carry pictures of that wedding? She's got pictures. Please ask her. And this guy played this wonderful, deep voice, sang The Lady in Red, and that was her wedding dance, The Lady in Red. It was awesome. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. It was just wonderful. And, you know, it was great. Thank you for having me there. Okay, trashed her pretty good. Let me see where I'm at. I've been in this magnificent fellowship of ours since February the 7th of 1969. I came in in Lubbock, Texas at the Central Group, and my sponsor was and is and has been all these years Pat Clater from Austin now, and her sponsor is Octavia, and then her sponsor was Marcy, and Marcy's sponsor was Marion, and then there was no Al-Anon, so there was just they started the auxiliary, I think. And I believe I stand, well, I know, I stand on the shoulders of giants in this program because these people whittled out what most of us enjoy today. You know, when I walk in and I tell everybody, and I say it all the time, when I walked in to my first meeting, the lights were on, the coffee was made, and those spiritual chairs were set up just waiting for me. And these women, it wasn't that way. I mean, when they got here, they weren't particularly welcome. They were in the kitchen. And I remember Marcy telling one time that they were in the kitchen. One time she went and the AAs had put up a rope over the kitchen door. She just took it down, went on in. Yeah. I have loved alcoholics from the get-go. I've been surrounded by alcoholics. I believe I may be a carrier. There's nothing about this that I don't like, with the exception it may work so slow. That's it. I'm like for instant gratification, as they say, and recovery sometimes is slow. But I wouldn't be anywhere else this Saturday morning. Thank you for having me here. I love my life, the ups and the downs and everything about it. I love it. I've had 3 major alcoholics and a lot of minor ones in between. And I had 3 brothers and a mom and dad. And my mom and dad were just, you know, good folks. Yeah, they're just good folks. My daddy was a part Indian from Oklahoma, and mother was from a divorced family, and that certainly didn't happen in her era. And they got together and had us kids and just stayed together, because that's what you did, you just stayed together. My oldest brother broke his neck in a swimming accident, and it changed my life forever. I started staying with friends and family, hardly saw my family for many years while he was nearly dead, and they took him here and they took him there and they brought him to Dallas, and he stayed here for a while. And I stayed with other people and always felt out of place. I was. And I hated it, and lived that way for many, many years, thought that way for many, many years. My house was a house that was not pleasant. There wasn't the good air conditioning there is nowadays. My friend, their air conditioner broke last night, and so Sherilyn was home fanning dogs, and that's the way we lived. And my brother's condition was, you know, not good. He had rotting flesh, and they packed this orange stuff on the rotting flesh and the heat and the smells, and he had catheters, and which weren't like they are today, and it's just old urine and old flesh and this dried smoke in there, and it just was a terrible place. I stayed out in the streets and played all the time, as far as I could go and as late as I could. And there was a lot of fussing and fighting in my house, and or quiet. That's all it was. Fussing and fighting or quiet. There was no joy. There was no happiness. I don't remember. And right before my mother died, she, you know, it's like she was 80 years old at this time, and I was in my 60s. And my mother said to me on the phone one day, she said, you know, I've been thinking, I feel so bad because I never played games with you kids. She said, mothers are supposed to play games and do things like that. And I thought, isn't it amazing that she's thinking about this at this time of her life? She just went back over, I guess, getting ready to move on. The church people came one day. I can remember this like it was yesterday. The church people came, and they brought sack after sack after sack in the house. And my daddy turned this gray look, and he went outside in the backyard away from them. My mother sat down on the couch and started crying. And this little heavily endowed church lady started hugging me. And she caught me in here because I was... She smelled like roses, and she was smothering me, and she was saying, Jesus loves you, Jesus loves you, and all I want to do was go get and go out in the backyard, because, man, she was smothering me, and there wasn't nothing pleasant about anything I just saw. Nothing pleasant about it. And shortly thereafter, I don't know, you know, didn't know I was going to be telling this, but shortly thereafter, a bunch of people came and, I like that one. A bunch of people came, and if I remember correctly, they put my brother on a mattress in the floor, which was a big deal because he was paralyzed and had tongs in his head and up on a pulley, and it was really a hard thing to do. And they all gathered around him on their knees, and they were praying, and they were praying really loud, and they're holding their hands up, and they were screaming and talking funny. I didn't understand what they were saying, and just really carrying on, making a big racket in there. And it scared me, and I went in to see if he's okay. And I saw this, and I was frightened, so I went back out, and then later it got quiet, and they left, so I went in there and to check on my brother, and he was grinning. And he said, you know what, these people just prayed over me, I've been healed, and I'm going to walk. And the first thing I'm going to do is chase you around the backyard. So I go in the living room, sit on the couch, and wait. And waited, and waited, and waited. And of course that did not happen. He was a paraplegic. So from the sights and sounds that I heard at that age, my decisions were made for me and kept those decisions until I was in Al-Anon. There is not a God. Their prayer does not work. These people will smother you. It made my daddy go out in the backyard. My mama cried. What would you want with these people? And I read an article in a magazine. In fact, a girl gave it to me not too long ago. And it was in Life magazine. And there's a 2-page spread. And it said, is God dead? I thought, that's it. He lived, you know, they lived a long time back there. And there was one, but he's dead. And there is nothing but your own self. And I lived that way. And one of the older girls asked me one time if I wanted to go out to the Cotton Club. And I didn't know what that was. But we walked in, and the band was playing extremely loud. There was a ball, you know, one of those old balls in the ceiling, and had a bunch of mirrors, but half of them was falling out, and this little colored, and it was going round and round, and I'm watching this, and I'm watching this loudness, and they're on the, and it smells of old urine and old stinking body and puke and stale. I thought, oh my God, this is home. I mean, you know, it's like, I was excited about it. And I got out there and I found out real quick what you do. It's real simple. You know, the guys are over here on the bar and the gals are over here. And you wait till about 11-ish. And about 11-ish, the guys start falling off the stools and they'll start coming this way. And you make sure that you've had yours picked out. Many of you know Jim Williams. And he said, all the time, he said, if you'd line 10 pretty girls up against the wall, I'd pick the sickest one every time. I said, Jim, you never figured out that the sickest one always took one step forward. Listen, I scoped out way before closing time. Way, I knew exactly who, what, and where. You see, because I needed something here. I needed something to fill this hole. I needed something, and I had figured it out. What you do is what Doris Day and Rock Hudson did in the movies, you know. You get married, you have 2.4 kids, you have a swimming pool and this great big huge shaggy dog and a station wagon with wood on the side, and you fix orange juice for your kids in the morning and you're happy. So I just needed the hymn to start out with. And that's what I was doing out there. And I 11-ish, I'd have him picked out and wait till closing times and manipulate, and you know, it's hard work. It's really hard work because, you know, my nemesis my whole life has been blondes. Let me tell you, you've got to watch the blondes. Real ones. They'll get your man every time, or try to. So I've got to watch the blondes, make sure I'm in position, get to him, make sure I've gotten his attention before the last dance, get over there, manipulate. One of my friends in AA and the Pacific Group, she said something, like, man, I wish I'd have thought of it. She always got a table by the men's restroom. So when the door opened up and the light from the men's, it would land on her and she I never thought about that. And they always played the same one. I wound up in a place called the Bloody Bucket. The Bloody Bucket didn't open till 2 a.m. And that's where I finally got. Because once I discovered what you have to pay the dues to pay to get somebody here, I figured what that was. You have to give a little and take a little and give a little and take a little. And I started giving up all the morals that I had been taught by my grandmother and all the things that you dream about, being married and the 2.4 kids. I gave all that up because I learned on the dance floor some exciting things. Number one, I was held. I mean, on the dance floor, men hold you really tight, especially if they're, you know, 11-ish. And it's, I'd never been hugged. My folks didn't hug. I was never told I love you. I've never put tucked into bed. None of those things, like many of us in this disease, happens. So I'd never been hugged, rocked, touched, anything. I don't even remember a hug until I got there. And their arms around, I mean, just the body language was something that I got so hooked on so quick, because something happened in here when I was being held. It was wonderful. And I started giving away a piece of my soul. Actually, I just became a slut puppy hoe, you on the truth. Yeah. Put it any way you want to, but. And I was listening to somebody from a podium, much like Debbie described last night. She was talking about drink, and it was kind of filled this up. Well, I heard a man speaking, and he said he took that drink, and it came down in here and just went like boom. And it came back up, and it just filled him up. And he got big old arms, and he was Superman, and he could go do anything, and he just felt like a man, and it was just, the world was right. And when he said that, I knew exactly what he's talking about. It happened to me at closing time at the song Sleepwalk. Y'all know Sleepwalk at Texas, surely. You know, it's the guitar, just the guitar, and it's really good, and I can almost do it. So I'm going to give y'all a demonstration. It's the closing song. It's Sleepwalk, and we're in the position. You know, yeah, you know. Yeah. It's that position. You couldn't put a human hair in between us, you know. Just dancing, dancing, dancing. I love dancing. And Sleepwalk's on. And it kind of goes like this. Near, near. Near, 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 near. Little tricks of the trade the big girls taught me, you know, and he's right here. He's right here in this ear. And oh God, that warm breath. And he's saying, sugar, I need you. Oh. Yes! Yes! And I went after that feeling for many, many years to come. That I need you. I can, please take care of me. You betcha I can help you, boy. I just, you can see the potential and you can just, you know, work with it. And it was, and I loved it. I loved being out there. I loved everything about it. And I met my first major alcoholic. He came by the table one night and flipped a $100 bill on the table. And you know that walk? I bet you do this, Kent. He said, here, why don't you trip around on this a while? And just walked on off. Well, I'd never seen a $100 bill, and I was thrilled. I mean, I was absolutely thrilled. And I spent his money, and I went after him. And we had a meaningful relationship. And after my daughter Tracy was born, he said, I've done all I can do for you. You're going to have to move on. Now, that to me is a red flag in front of a bull. You just don't say that to me. Because my Al-Anon isms, if you will, come blooming, blossoming. Number one, manipulation, control, I know best. But the biggest one is, you know what? You can treat me any way you want to. I mean, you can just live with me. You don't have to marry me. I know what I am. I'm a piece of garbage. You don't have to live with me. You don't have to make it right with this child, this unborn child that has no say-so in life. That's okay. I'll do whatever. I'll stay here and let you beat me up. I'll stay here and let you not come home for days. I'll do all that. Just don't leave me. If you leave me, I will disappear. Don't abandon me. And he did that, and you can't do that to me. Because if you do, then I have to become vengeful. I have to let you know how deeply you've hurt me. I have to do some manipulation to show you. I've got to do something to get you back so I can survive. So what I did was go across town to somebody he absolutely hated, bad blood, you know, manipulated this guy, made his drinks a little bit stronger, a little bit faster. And I could do that if I needed something from the alcoholic. Trust me, I'm not proud of that. Not at all. And got him drunk enough where he would go to the other side of town to the Bloody Bucket. So I could flaunt myself in front of him and with this gambler. This guy was a gambler. And let him see what he was missing and make him jealous. And then he would want me back. And so I did this one particular night. And a couple days later, he took a shotgun and blew this man's head off. Now, I never, ever, ever expected that would happen. Not in my wildest dreams. He threatened to do things like that. He threatened to do it to me. And he threatened to do it to other people that I would mess with. But I never, that's in the movies. It doesn't really happen. Well, it did. And they came and told me about it that morning, and the sun was just coming up. And I can see that sun anytime I want to go back there. I can see all this. And the sun's coming up, and Juanita's standing there telling me what has happened. And this pain is coming in my chest and in my throat so bad, so deeply, that I cannot breathe. I cannot take the next breath. It's hung. And the sun all of a sudden is going back down. I'm thinking, why is the sun going back down? And then it was like, you know, this is extremely painful. I cannot, I will not do this. And boom, just like that, it went away. And I put my shoulders back and I stuffed that feeling, and I had that feeling for some 15 years until I got into this program. I stuffed it. I don't know where, but it went away. And it was awful. It was a terrible feeling. It was all over the newspapers. It was on the radio. And my parents, God love them, they had enough with me having a child out of wedlock. It was just devastating for them. My mother was in the Rebecca Lodge, and she'd just been asked to be a state officer, and she was so thrilled because she had no life. My mom and dad had no life. They took care of my brother all the time. And when this came out, they asked her to step down. Not because of what she did, but because of what I was doing. It was very painful for my mother. And I came over, and she met me at the door, and she said, you know what, we'd rather you not come over here. We don't want the neighbors seeing you come in and out, and if anybody asks if you're our daughter, would you just tell them you're not. And I said, okay, Mama. I understood that. That wasn't painful for me. I just understood it. Of course. I was an embarrassment. I was a nothing. I was a piece of garbage attached to these people, and they were just good, hardworking people. And I said, of course. My dad, you know, kept coming and getting Tracy, and they adored my daughter. which probably saved her life. And I'm thinking, what am I? I got to change my life. Something's got to change. This has got to be different. And I said, I had no God. I had no morals. I had no creed. I had nothing. I decided to go across town and get a cowboy. Now, everybody, it was the time where cowboys weren't tearing up their draft cards and they were flying the flag, and it was a big thing. And so I went to the rodeos. Because one of the older girls went to the rodeo. So I went over there. After the rodeo, there's a big slab of concrete on the side of the place, and there's a fence around it, and the band plays here. And the cowboys lean up against that fence, and the girls lean up at this fence. About 11-ish, the cowboys come starting. So I picked a bull rider. He looked so great in jeans. You cannot believe how good that man looked in Levi's. And he was the champion bull rider and the best dancer, and he wore a white hat. And I got him. I mean, I scoped him out and I got him. And sometime into our meaningful relationship, he took a big empty quart brown beer bottle. It was on the table, and he was punching me in the chest with his finger. I got that bottle and just busted him upside the head, and he fell to his knees. I figured I better get, and I did. And he chased me outside, and he spun me around, and he said, "You know what? I think you just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married." Shoot, it worked for me, you know. However you can get them. Sidebar, one of the girls I sponsor is celebrating 23 years of marriage today. Jim and Virginia, right? Stand up. And that's with program. They met in program. And God bless both of you. I love these people, and he's a really good dancer, too. And so we got married. I mean, I kept him drunk until 3 days later till we could get everything done because I was in a hurry because I didn't want him sober up. And we got married. Do you hear what I'm telling you? I was married. That's the dream. It's the dream since I had a kid, and I knew the dream was lost. I lost all my dreams. They were all gone. Alcoholism and my ism stripped me of everything. There was nothing. There was no dreams. I had no dignity. I had very few friends left, to tell you the truth. I had nothing. And when he said married, I mean, I jumped on that. And we got married. And it was a great marriage for the first 7 days, you know. And then, then it happened. And I found my position at the window. I stood at that window and watched and listened for that pickup. I could hear that pickup 3 miles down the road. I could hear the ting-tang, ting-tang, bling-plank. You know, not the da-da-da-da-da-da. It was the ting-tang, bling-plank, ding-dank. And I could hear it. I had a little boy trying to make this a family and special, and it didn't work. I could kept the kids in the back room with the door shut. And they were more frightened of me than they were the drunk. Because they could tell what he was going to do by his smell. They could never tell what I was going to do. Never. They didn't know if I'm going to scream, jump, hit him. They never knew. I never knew. I was rageful. I would get angry and I'd just build on it and build. You know, just let it, where is he? You know, it's midnight. Why isn't he here? Why isn't he here? Standing at that door and waiting and waiting and listening and looking. And just it would just come and come and come. And he'd pull up. And I run and jump in the bed and play like I'm asleep. Now, there's something not right. And I would ask him, where have you been? What are you doing? What is it? Go look in the ashtray, see if there's lipstick. Check in the seat for blonde hair. I mean, I stayed so busy. I mean, I was busy. You have got to be on alert. You've got to watch. You've got to listen. You've got to see. Who could take care of kids in this busyness? I couldn't get away. They weren't hugged. They weren't kissed. They weren't tucked to bed. I didn't play games with my kids. I was busy. I'd yank him up in the middle of the night and would go to the bar and do a drive-by and see if we could find him. Sometimes I would leave him in the car. I would go in. I would start kicking over tables. I'd start throwing big, giant glasses of jugs of beer. Just madness. I hurt my kids a lot. I did a lot of damage to my children. One Thursday, I was sitting in a chair. I had quit going to the bars. I quit calling. I'd quit hunting. I'd quit looking. I'd quit doing anything. He'd just come in and go out, and I'd hope when he came in, it would just be quiet. My friend Albert Myers, God bless his soul, told me one time about one of the Altines that said to him, he asked the Altine how things were at home, and he said, well, sounds pretty good. He said, what do you mean, sounds? And my daughter explained that to me many years later. She would go to bed, and those kids never quite went to sleep. Not quite. Same way I did. I was always almost asleep. And then they would hear the pickup. They heard the bling bling too. They'd hear the pickup, and they'd come in, and they'd listen. They would just listen because the door was shut. They'd listen to see what was going on. My daughter was praying, I hope Mama keeps her mouth shut tonight. I hope Mama keeps her mouth shut tonight. Not anything about her dad. It was, I hope Mama keeps her mouth shut tonight. And some nights it was quiet and some nights it wasn't. And I quit saying anything to him. One of the girls I sponsored, Debbie Dew, said, you know, what you're describing is what Dante wrote. And Dante says, the definition of hell is the absence of all feelings. And I understood immediately what she said, because we quit laughing, I quit crying, I quit getting mad, I quit getting sad. I just sat. And one Thursday I was sitting in that chair. I had two black eyes and a busted lip, because that's the way we lived. And I thought, I just can't do this anymore. There was nothing, no family left. I had two friends left, and they were barely there. The neighbors stayed away, that my children weren't welcome in their home, and they could not come to our home because you never knew what was going to explode over there. And there was just nothing. And I thought, I wish I could kill myself for a little while just to get out of this. I knew I couldn't, because there was no place to put those children. No place. And I was sitting there, and I remembered an article that I'd read in Ann Landers. And it was from a woman who's, you know, I could have signed it. And I remember Ann Landers saying, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what I did. And I got this man on the phone. And we talked, and he gave me this lady's number, and I called her, and she invited me over, and I went over to her house. And I talked to her for a long time. Her husband came in. He was a sober member of AA, and I talked to him. They invited me to a meeting. They said they'd pick me up, and I made arrangements for my kids, and I went to my first meeting. When we got out of the car and went to the door, he opened the door and held it back like this and stepped back and looked at me. And I thought, what does he want? Is something wrong? Something wrong with the door? What? You know, I remember thinking, what's he doing? And then it dawned on me. This was a gentleman. That's what they do in the movies. You can tell I saw movies a lot. He was treating me like a lady. I never was so surprised in my life. It was my first introduction. That door, I walked through that door, and two guys were at the end of this long, skinny little coffee room. And they were leaning up against this cigarette machine. And back then, they had little slots, you know, with the advertisement on the front. And it was all different colors. And you put in a quarter, ha, 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 and pulled and let it go. And it slid down, and it just glowed. And these two guys were leaning up against that. And this glow was in their face, and they were laughing. I'm talking laughter. The music of AA. The laughter. And I stood there, and that was the first two things of my journey. Was someone opened the door for me, and then ahead of me was laughter. And I was hooked right then. And I went in, and she went into the Al-Anon room with me, and she had never been in an Al-Anon meeting before in her since, and sat with me. And I don't think I listened. I think I looked. You know, we were talking about it yesterday, about dressing up from behind this podium. This podium is just a holy ground to me, and I respect it with every being, fiber of my being, and to wear a skirt and a dress. And those women that were behind that thing were wearing skirts and dresses, and always have, and they still do. And it's a newcomer. They can't hear what we're saying, but they can see who we are. And what I saw in that room that night was these clean, shiny women and men. There were several men there, and they were, there was something going on. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know what it was, but there was something in that room. Much later, I read the prophet Cahil Gibran, and he says, "Say not that that God is in your heart, but that you are in the heart of God." And I knew when I read that, that's what that feeling was that night. And it's what that feeling is for me when I'm alert all the time when I walk into a meeting. When we walked into this hotel, there was just a few people, but the few people that we saw, they were grinning and laughing, and you knew that this was going to be a deal just when you first walked in, because it was happening, it was generating, and it was that way for me. And I have been coming back ever since. After I was around about 3 months, I think, we don't know for sure, but there was two doors to that room, and I would slip out right after the men. I was out. A couple of reasons. One of them is I thought if you knew where I came from, I would not be welcome here. And this place is the one place that I had been in my whole entire life that I felt safe and that I wanted to be. That there was a feeling here that I wanted to feel. And if you knew where I came from, I didn't think I'd be welcome. The second thing was, I'd have to talk to you. What in the world would I say to you? I just didn't know. So I'd slip out. And one day, Pat and Randa decided that one would take each door and try to catch me. And I chose this door, and Pat was standing there, and she said some, you know, it was a divine appointment. She said some things to me that only she could say and only I could hear. And somehow or another, later I asked her to be my sponsor. And she's been my sponsor ever since, and she's still doing the deal. She's doing, you know, she goes to meetings, and someone mentioned her illness. She just was so ill last year that she was in ICU on a breathing respirator, and actually she died. I saw, and she's come back to life and doing great. I mean, she's great. She's upset because she didn't make arrangements to come here, actually. She's the first person who ever said to me that out loud that I knew she meant it. I didn't know exactly why, but I knew that she meant it. She looked at me and she said, "No, I really love you. I really care about you." And for some reason or another, I believed that when I hadn't believed it before in my whole life. So because she said that to me, I tried to do everything that she asked me to that day to this. And I try to do what she does. I watch her and I do what she does. I had these two kids. I started coming to meetings, and this little cowboy at first was glad I was off his back, and then he started wondering what I was doing. And one day a guy said, "He's going to accuse you of having a boyfriend," and sure enough he did, and it just cracked me up. And he hired a private investigator to see where I was going. I mean, he'd be missing for days, you know, and he that still gives me a kick. One of the guys told me immediately, said, "Why don't you keep your mouth shut?" I thought, wow, what a concept. I never even thought about that. So I quit getting in his face, and I started letting him be and started listening to him. You know, I go to two Al-Anon meetings and one open AA meeting every week. And I heard from the podium behind AA, the speakers, They were talking about what they used to be like and what they were doing. It's what my cowboy was doing at that moment. And I began to understand it really was a disease. I began to understand he wasn't doing it at me. He was doing it because he had this disease. And I started getting some understanding and some compassion and started really caring for him again. And one of the guys came up to me once and said, you know, if you wouldn't talk like that, we'd respect you a lot more. Whoa. My sponsor and my grand sponsor said, you know, if you wouldn't dress like that, you would look more like a lady and you'd start feeling like that inside, just little by little by little. And I started getting the things that I hear here, and I started figuring out what that meant because I listened to you and I did what you asked me. I sometimes was really arguing with you in here, but I never had the courage to say it out loud. And things got better and better for me, and after I'd been in Al-Anon for a year, my cowboy came for a while. He stayed sober 6 months, and then he realized he wasn't really, really an alcoholic. He went back out. And 7 years later, he came in one night, and he walked in the door, came in, flipped the light on, and started beating me up. And I fell off the foot of the bed, and my body got caught up in the sheets, and my face hit the floor, and it bounced back up. And when I did that, I saw my two kids in the door. And they were, this was seconds. From the door to the room to the lights, boom, and they were screaming. And my little son's feet was just dancing a little jig. And my daughter was saying, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't hit her anymore. And for the first time ever, I saw my children's faces. I saw what was going on in their life. And I was amazed. And I got out of there. And I left that marriage. And, you know, it says here when the student's ready, you know, the teacher will appear. And things just started happening. I mean, I got into school. I got a car. I got a place to live. I got help from the AAs. There's one guy who was a member of Texas Rehab, and they got me in school. One guy worked for a bank. They got me a bank loan so I could get through school. And next thing I knew, I was a nurse. For pity's sakes, a nurse. I was a high school dropout. I never dreamed I could do any of that stuff. But my sponsor, my grand sponsor, and a lot of people in the room helping me, I got through this school. And when we graduated, they asked me to give the class response, and I was up talking to these people, and the place was, it was this big old huge church, and it was just packed, and huge bunch right here was all my AA and Al-Anon family. And right in the middle was my mom and my dad. And the neighbors. And my dad, I was thanking the family for helping us get through. My dad looked at the neighbor, Mr. Stewart, and he said, that's my kid up there. I could read his lips. And it was one of those moments in your life that you cherish. Because I had been told to make amends, make a living amends, and do the things. And I went to make amends to my mother, and she'd say, well, blood's thicker than water. That was her standard thing. But I went over there every Sunday, as I was told to do, for 10 minutes. And then I went for 15 minutes. And then I went for 20 minutes. And slowly but surely, they all forgave me. I made amends to my brothers. My one brother, Jimmy, he would not speak to me. He hadn't spoken to me in 26 years. He wouldn't have anything to do with me. He had two kids, my niece Tanya and Butch, my nephew. I wasn't allowed in their house, and my kids couldn't go to their house. And I wrote him a letter of amends, he didn't respond to it. My mother said to me, I'll tell you this much, your brother got your amends. And I said, thank you, and that's all she said. My father died a few years later, and I was able to take care of my dad. And it was a blessing among blessings. And my brother came to town, and he just said to me, if he needs anything, call me. And I said, okay. And then when my dad died, my brother came to me. And he said, would you like for me to go get your children out of school? And I said, please. So he went and got my kids at school and brought them and told them about their grandpa. And that's the only thing he said to me in all those years. And many years later, which I always thought, and it did come to light, that he was an alcoholic. And he took a gun and he killed himself because he couldn't find sobriety. But his kids are sober. They're sober. I divorced this guy, and I'm working, and I have my two kids, and they're doing good. And Tracy, my daughter, she starts. You know, they say you cannot say one person's an alcoholic. They have to say it themselves. I also heard from this podium, if they waddle like a duck, quack like a duck, chances are they're a duck. She was doing all this waddling and quacking, and she and I started having that ripping and tearing and hatred, just pure hatred. And she left home and went to do her life. And I hated it. I just hated it because I had heard too many women from behind this podium talk, and I knew where she was headed, and I really hated it for her. And shortly after that, my son disappeared. His drunk daddy come and got him, and I was going to try to help him and put him in a boys' ranch to get his life because his dad had taken him and fed him wine one night, and he was 11, and I was going to try to save this one from being an alcoholic, don't you know? And his daddy took him, and my son called and said, I'm going to stay with my daddy. And I was just devastated. My kids, look at this mess after all I had done for them. And I had to write an inventory on my kids, and I took it with my sponsor, and I saw where I had really been a lousy mother. And I also saw where I had been a really good mother. And that what I was dealing with in my immediate family was alcoholism. And I hate alcoholism. I just hate it. I hate everything about it. My problem is I love the alcoholic. So I have to stay here so y'all can help me separate the two and put them where they belong. And so as best I could, I have released my children one day at a time to God as I understand him to do their journey. And they've had journeys, I'll tell you. I was divorced, single, kids gone, and I met this man named Jim Shaw from California. Big, deep voice, big old blue eyes, little gray temples, you know, just really good looking and a lot of diamonds. The diamonds caught my attention first, and then the spirituality second. And after a terrible romance, we broke up, and he told me he couldn't do this anymore, and I had just quit my job, gave away all my furniture, had everything in a U-Haul trailer, fixed to go to California. Susan gave me a big going away party, and he came to Texas, said, I can't do this. I've gotten in touch with my feelings. Oh, please. No offense, but alcoholics are biggest cowards in the world when it comes. I mean, a relationship, they just turn pale and pink and start fainting, and you have, obviously. No offense, just the way y'all are. And eventually we got back together, but in that period of time, I was so angry. I'd skip this if I could, but my sponsor said I have to. And there are snitches in this audience. I was so angry at God for what he had done to me. It wasn't Jim, because I knew Jim. You know, he just did the best he could. I knew that. I was so angry at God. Why would you give me these things and let me see them and take it away? Why was everybody else in relationships and their kids were doing well and their lives were going better and better, and the son's the football player and the daughter's the little cheerleader, just bought the wife a new Cadillac, and thank God, day, I now own my own business, and, you know, screw you. My life is hell, and I've done a lot better than three-fourths of y'all. I've worked harder, sponsored more people, you know, did the coffee, I've done GR, I was GR, I did all that stuff. What's wrong with me? What is it? And I took out after Brand New Sober Man. Let me show you what AA is about. And I am thoroughly ashamed of that today. It just kills me to say that. My sponsor makes me. I had two men I was just messing with. And one of them told on the other one, and then called my sponsor, and I got caught, and it was just. It was bad. And we were at this lakeside conference in Brownwood, Texas, and it was late at night, and I'd just gotten caught, and my sponsor was sitting on this quilt on the grass, and everybody had gone to bed, and I was telling her, you know, I just feel so bad about this, and I just feel like God's betrayed me. And she said, well, do you think you've ever betrayed God? And somehow or another, it's like Debbie said, the new coat of paint was put on that, and it got my attention. And I said, Pat, there's something about me I've never told you. I've never told anybody. Didn't want to tell anybody. But I need to tell you. And it's the truth. I don't know what it is, but I am unlovable. I don't know why. I am just unlovable. My kids have gone away. They don't love me. I haven't been able to keep men. My parents don't love me. I mean, I'm just unlovable, and I don't know what that is. If I knew, I'd certainly fix it. And I started a little tear, and then pretty soon I was sobbing, and she reached over and she pulled me and put my head on her shoulder, and she started just this slow little rocking, and she said, Vinoy, that's not so. She said, I love you with all your warts. She said, if I can love you with my human power, just imagine how much God loves you. And you are all right, and you are lovable. And for some reason or other, I heard it. And I came back, and I went to my group, and I started sweeping again and started making the coffee again, and I was so grateful that I hadn't been kicked out, which I should have been. And it was a long time before I, you know, got those feelings back and laughed. We still talk about the first time I laughed after months and months. And from that time to this, whatever this program asks of me, I just say, okay. I mean, there's nothing I can do to put back in here what I've received. Nothing. I don't care how hard and how long I try. So it's just okay. Whatever you ask, okay. Will you make the coffee? Okay. Will you come to Dallas? Okay. Will you go over here? Okay. Will you sponsor me? Okay. You know, will you make up the bed? Okay. You know, what do you need? Because you have saved my life. Jim came back in my life, and he came back with two drunk kids. So we stirred all this up. We got married. We stayed in Norman, Oklahoma for a while. We stayed here. We lived here in Dallas a couple of years, and then we wound up back in California. His business went back together. We had, you know, we were successful out there. We were doing great. My daughter heard her story in an AA meeting and got sober, and she met a young man on campus, and they got pregnant, and they got married, and then they got divorced, and Jim and I got them. So I have a granddaughter, Sharday. She's 19 today. And when she was a little kid, I think she was 8 or 9, Tracy had 10 years of sobriety, and Debbie just blew me out of my seat last night. She got the craving to drink with 10 years. And if you ask her that question, did you ask God to keep you sober today, she would have said no, because she went out with 10 years. And I know the statistics. Well, somebody with 10 years don't usually come back, but somehow she did. She got back. She moved over to Phoenix. There's a young group over there that's very active. She loved it there, so she came back. She was sober 2.5 years. She called me one night, asked me if I was sitting down, please. Now I call it, calls you, are you sitting down? She had sent my granddaughter to live with a dad, and she hadn't lived with Tracy in many, many years, and so she was single and by herself, and she'd met this hairy lugged kid from Lubbock, where we were from, and on Christmas vacation, this was May, and they just run to Vegas and got married. Now, I knew this kid, and he is bad news. He is not sober. And I said, you just got married. God, I said, where y'all gonna live in Arizona, or are you going back to Texas? And she said, well, we've got to hurry up and get back to Texas before his parole officer finds out he's out of state. So she didn't stay sober long, needless to say. And this young man was driving really too fast right here in Dallas and had a car wreck, and became a vegetable. He's a vegetable today. My daughter got sober again. She's sober and living in Arizona, and she's got 7 years and doing well. She's got a nice job. just bought a beautiful home, and she's doing well today. You know, it's just Saturday. And my granddaughter's had two meaningful relationships, both drug addicts. And this last one that she just broke up with a couple of months ago is a drug addict plus a mental disease. And last week, they had to get a restraining order. He's been in jail. He just got it for months, and he just got out. And the psychiatrist called my daughter, my granddaughter, and said that he had been in the office, and by law, he had to call and tell them that the boy says he's going to kill my granddaughter. And most people, you know, I mean, I pay attention because murder's already been in my life. And I said, Tracy, we have to, you really have to pay attention to this. So they're paying attention. And in the meantime, my granddaughter's seeing what a little whiskey and a little cocaine are like. Jim brought these two kids to me. Jim Jr. is sober. He has 4 years. He did not get sober while his dad was still alive, but he's trying to make up for that by doing the things his daddy would have him to do, and he's doing a seemingly a fine job. Sheila, many of you know my Sheila. She came back to Norman when Jim and I lived there with a child that she had out of wedlock, Brad. And I told Jim, we got to help. This is our way to pay back. And so she stayed in Norman with us, and she got sober, and she got married. She has another young man, and she's doing outstanding. Many of you know her. She's doing a great job. And Brad, my little Brad, is just the dumbest alcoholic you've ever seen in your life. I mean, he is just dumb. He gets caught at everything he does. He got a 16-year-old girl pregnant, and they shotgun wedding, and then they got divorced. And before they got divorced, he was, you know, this new technology, text messaging. At 4 o'clock in the morning, she wakes up, he's not there. She text messages him, and he text messages her back. So, I'm so sorry I fell asleep on Steve or somebody's couch. I'll be home in the morning. Don't disturb you. Just go sleep. I love you. Good night. A few minutes later, text message come back to her again, and it says, Steve, I told my wife I'd sleep on your couch, so if she text message, tell her I'm there. I mean, he's always doing dumb stuff like that. He's disappeared for the last few months somewhere on the south coast of Texas, and Sheila called me yesterday, and she said she'd finally heard about him. He's shrimping on a shrimp boat. He's from Norman, Oklahoma. Tell me what he knows about shrimp. I mean, he's like. But you know what? Y'all have my kids, because I can't. I've give up the guilt. I've give up the control. I've give up the trying. You know, I have scars on my heart. And sometimes those scars pulsate. And when my little granddaughter is looking at me and my daughter is in my arms sobbing because some man's going to kill her daughter, those scars really pulsate. But I left knowing that she's in your hands. I give you my kids because I trust you with my kids. I can't do anything with them, not a thing. And you have the most precious thing that I have is my children. I told you that I stand on the shoulders of giants, and one of them was Bob White. Many of you knew him, and I was able to help take care of him when he was dying because of my nursing. And he told this story at the Canyon Conference, the first one. And he was ill, and I went over to take care of him for a week, and I told him I told this story, and he said, please keep telling it. So I closed my talks with Bob's suggestion because he'd haunt me if I didn't. But that morning at the Canyon Conference, he said, we close every meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And it starts off with our Father, and in there it says, kingdom, power, and the glory forever. So if there's a king and it's our Father, that makes you and I royalty. That makes you and I princes and prince of the kingdom. He said, claim your heritage, act like it, treat each other that way. And the power is in these rooms. It's in with each other, and we feel it all the time. And the glory is God, and he is glory all over us. He said, I challenge you, please say that prayer. I pray that prayer, not just say it. And I listened to him that morning, and I thought, you know, I'm going to do that. I'm going to live like royalty, and I'm going to treat you like royalty. And I know who I am today. I know what I am. I am a child of the king. I am Princess Vinoy. And y'all have given me that. And my children are children. They're not grandchildren. They're children of the king. for that in my life. I thank you so much.
Thank you, Bernard. She's up here yelling, "Give me my present."